KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The head of USAID under President George W. Bush tells us allegations of widespread fraud and abuse at the agency are nonsense. He says cuts from President Trump and Elon Musk will lead to deaths around the globe. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Coming up, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says her fellow Democrats are not shocked or on the defensive. I'm Michelle Martin.
And Amy Martinez, AOC, speaks on how her party is resolved to take back control of the federal government. Also, as Ramadan begins, how some young Muslims are prepared to fast, and a new system for EV tax breaks leads to surprise bills. It's Friday, February 28th. Today in 1993, ATF agents tried to execute a search warrant at the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas, leading to a 51-day standoff. News is next.
Live from NPR News, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump welcomed Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to the White House today. They are supposed to sign a preliminary agreement on sharing Ukrainian critical minerals with the United States. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports Trump insists this is a major step toward reaching a peace deal with Russia.
President Trump says the agreement will provide the U.S. access to minerals that are essential for aviation and defense technology. Trump also sees it as a chance for the U.S. to recoup some of the billions of dollars that U.S. taxpayers have spent helping Ukraine defend itself against the Russian invasion. Trump also said he believes Russian President Vladimir Putin would respect the terms of any deal. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
Aid programs for millions of people are collapsing worldwide. This comes after the U.S. Agency for International Development and the State Department announced this week the termination of contracts worth nearly $60 billion. NPR's Gabriela Emanuel has more.
Michaela Hilo is a program manager at the Ethiopian nonprofit Organization for Social Services, Health and Development. He learned U.S. funding for his work with HIV-positive children was terminated.
This is just a disaster.
The termination means his program is laying off all 135 workers, and the 1,600 children and adolescents they work with are without their HIV medication. He fears that without medicine to keep the virus in check, the kids will fall ill.
We don't even want to open our eyes to see the disaster that's coming.
His program is one of roughly 10,000 grants and contracts that were terminated. Others include clean water for refugee camps and food aid for malnourished children. Gabriela Emanuel, NPR News.
Egypt says talks to further the ceasefire agreement in Gaza between Israel and Hamas have opened in Cairo. That's as the current phase of the deal is set to expire this weekend. NPR's Kath Lonsdorf has more from Tel Aviv.
Egypt says that, quote, intensive discussions on the next stage of the ceasefire deal are underway. Israel confirmed it has sent a delegation to Cairo. Qatari officials are also present, mediating for Hamas, which says it remains committed to the deal. President Trump's Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff, is also expected in the region soon. The first phase of the ceasefire deal, which has lasted almost 6 weeks, ends this weekend, although Israel has expressed interest in extending it while details of the next phase continue to be hammered out. Phase two would see more hostages and Palestinian detainees released, as well as further withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza. More humanitarian aid would also be allowed into Gaza, which has been critical in recent weeks. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
On Wall Street, stocks are higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 282 points at 43,521. You're listening to NPR News. A federal judge in California has ruled that the Trump administration's mass layoffs of tens of thousands of federal workers are likely illegal. He's ordered a halt to the firings at some agencies and says they should be rescinded. The temporary restraining order is in effect until March 13th. That's when the judge will hold another hearing on the lawsuit. A former executive in the timber industry has been named the new head of the U.S. Forest Service. NPR's Kirk Siegler has more.
Tom Schultz has most recently been VP of Government Affairs for an influential Coeur d'Alene, Idaho-based timber company, and he'll now be back in the public sector managing close to 200 million acres of federal timberlands. Republicans are pledging to fast-track more logging on public land as a means of restarting timber economies and addressing the wildfire threat. Some of this was already underway during the Biden administration. In his resignation letter, the agency's outgoing chief, Randy Moore, a Biden appointee, warned that the agency had no say in the recent job cuts that he said will hamper its ability to manage land and fires. Kirk Siegler, NPR News, Boise.
A federal appeals court has ruled against President Trump's effort to overturn birthright citizenship to people whose parents are illegally in the U.S. Birthright citizenship is protected by the U.S. Constitution. The decision by the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals is the second time a federal appellate court has reviewed Trump's executive order and denied it. The issue of birthright citizenship is expected to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Coming up, influencers Andrew and Tristan Tate are facing human trafficking and sexual abuse charges in Romania. So how is it they were able to leave to travel to Florida? But first, one of the first targets of the Trump administration's federal workforce cuts was the U.S. Agency for International Development. The headquarters was shuttered weeks ago, but yesterday and today, those who work there are being allowed to return briefly to pick up their things. Here's NPR's Michelle Kellerman.
Supporters cheer as a man walks out of the Ronald Reagan building with a bag and a large picture from South Sudan. He had just 15 minutes to gather things from his desk.
I'm incredibly bitter and very angry, and nobody likes feeling that way, right? You know, we've sacrificed a lot. I've, you know, spent almost 20 years working solely on Sudan and South Sudan.
He won't give his name because for now he still has a job, though almost everyone at USAID has either been put on administrative leave or fired in recent weeks. He says he always believed that foreign assistance was one of the last bipartisan issues in Washington.
Well, it's a legacy that, you know, American taxpayers should be proud of. Let's not forget that. Historically, up until now, it's in less than 1% of the budget. And, you know, come on, talk to the average American. Do they want to see people dying because of assistance cutoff?
Secretary of State Marco Rubio has said that he's given waivers to life-saving aid programs to make sure they continue, but his team has been canceling contracts and so far refusing court orders to pay for some work that's already been done. Former President Biden's USAID Administrator Samantha Power describes it this way.
It's the ultimate shock and awe, not to give the courts, the citizens, even the silent majority of Republican members of Congress who support this work a chance to get their bearings and activate.
She was inside the building to greet former colleagues along with Obama's former administrator, Gail Smith.
It's shocking because, again, from a foreign policy point of view, this is crazy. You don't just cut off your arm and say, well, we'll figure out later whether or not we needed it.
She says she saw lots of experts walking out the door of the Ronald Reagan building. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
For more on what's happening at USAID, our co-host Leila Fadel spoke with Andrew Natsios. He is a conservative Republican, that's how he described himself, and he led USAID under President George W. Bush.
I want to start with what Musk has said about USAID. It's a criminal organization that needs to die. He's referred to it as a ball of worms. And President Trump said this. We'll just play this clip.
USAID, run by radical lunatics, and we're getting them out.
Now, you spent 5 years heading this agency. Is it rampant with fraud, waste, and abuse, and run by, quote, radical lunatics, as we heard from Trump?
Absolutely not. That's all nonsense. And in terms of accountability, there are layer upon layer of institutions and controls within the system. 40% of the aid officers, what they do is they make sure all the laws are complied with, but most importantly, that none of the money is misspent or stolen.
Now, what is the impact of 90% of USAID's foreign aid contracts being slashed?
Well, I mean, they're basically destroying the agency. They've laid off the 4,000 career direct hires. There are 1,800 Foreign Service officers. Most of the staff actually are Foreign Service nationals who are from the country we work in. The greatest strength of aid was the missions. And many of the local staff go on to become prime ministers, presidents, cabinet ministers. The first woman president of Costa Rica was a Foreign Service national who worked for USAID for 10 years. This is the case around the world. It was a training ground. And so we are now shutting down a system that trains people, and I might add, and they're very pro-American people, to public office in the developing world. Why would we do that? It's crazy.
And there are a sizable number of Americans who support this move, who would say, why is all this U.S. money going abroad when it should be spent here for Americans struggling? Why support continuing this funding, and how does it benefit the U.S.? I mean, this is an organization that was created under President John F. Kennedy and has been providing foreign aid for 6 decades.
Yes. For example, we shut down the aid mission in Panama because it's become a middle-income country. As soon as aid left, guess who moved in? The Chinese. Is the Panama Canal important to the United States? Of course it is. The Panama Canal almost shut down because there was a big drought. And what we typically would do, the government will frequently go, and countries all over the world in the global south, if they have a problem they can't solve, they'll go to the aid mission director and the U.S. ambassador and say, can you help us? But we weren't there. We had left. 50% of the food that's sold commercially goes through what are called choke points on the high seas, one of which is the Suez Canal, another is the Panama Canal. And we're one of the biggest exporters of food in the world. And we need open seas in order to ship our food, or it's going to affect the Midwest farmers. The other thing that's happening is there's still threats from these radical fundamentalist religious groups in Africa and the Middle East that are threatening our allies. AID has a role to play in stabilizing things.
So really what you're saying is that this move creates a less stable world and also seeds power and influence to China that's coming in with its Belts and Roads Initiative, this loan program into a lot of these countries.
Exactly.
Now, you're a lifelong Republican, active in the party, but you're not in step with your party right now. Republican lawmakers have stayed silent. Some made really tepid objections to the dismantling of USAID and other legally questionable actions by the administration. Why do you think they're not making the same objections that you are?
Privately, they'll tell you we're big supporters of aid. I think they're intimidated. They're afraid. And a lot of the people who are in the party now are devoted to the president and are carrying out his agenda and are getting quite aggressive about it.
Aid groups and advocates have warned that there is and will be loss of life. Life-saving programs, including ones that provide HIV medications, have been terminated. In Sudan, the most catastrophic humanitarian crisis in the world right now, for example, has 1,000 food aid kitchens that were supported by USAID. What fills the vacuum for USAID work?
No one does.
No one does.
60% of the food that the World Food Program, a UN agency, distributes comes from AID. That's shutting down now. So what's going to happen is a lot of people are going to die. I mean, there's no other way of putting it. I'm not trying to be an alarmist. Thousands of staff from the Global South who run many of these programs have been laid off.
Andrew Natsios, former administrator of USAID and professor at Texas A&M University, sharing his insights on the recent dismantling of the agency and its broader implications. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Andrew and Tristan Tate, brothers who faced charges in Romania for sexual abuse and human trafficking, are now in Florida.
Yeah, they arrived yesterday by private jet after their travel restrictions were lifted by Romanian authorities. Andrew Tate is a self-described misogynist with millions of followers on social media. He and his brother are vocal supporters of President Trump, and there are questions about whether the Trump administration may have played a role in relaxing their travel restrictions.
NPR's Greg Allen joins us now from Miami to tell us more about this. Good morning, Greg.
Hi, Michelle.
So just like A just said, why are we talking about Andrew Tate? He has a big following on TikTok and X, popular with some young men, where his sort of displays of masculinity and his extravagant lifestyle. So bring us up to date on what he's charged with.
Well, you know, he and his brother faced charges both in Romania and in the United Kingdom for being part of a criminal enterprise that allegedly lured women to Romania where they were sexually exploited. Andrew Tate also faces a rape charge. In December, a Romanian court said that the case against the Tates couldn't go to trial, though, because of procedural and legal mistakes that had been made by prosecutors. The case does remain open, though, and the brothers are supposed to be available to return to Romania to face charges when the time comes. But many are skeptical they will return now. We'll see. Here's what Andrew Tate had to say yesterday after arriving in Fort Lauderdale.
We live in a democratic society where it's innocent until proven guilty, and I think my brother and I are largely misunderstood. There's a lot of opinions about us, a lot of things that go around about us on the internet. We've yet to be convicted of any crime in our lives ever. We have no criminal record anywhere on the planet ever.
Tate says the charges against him and his brother are false, and they're based on lies that he says have been concocted by the media.
So for people who haven't been following this story, Greg, tell us again, who is Andrew Tate and how did he become so famous on social media?
Right. Well, you know, he's a former kickboxing champion who first became well-known nearly 10 years ago on the British version of the reality show Big Brother. He rose to fame, though, through social media, Twitter, now X, YouTube, and TikTok, where he posts about his success and his lifestyle. He's drawn a lot of attention with the outrageous and offensive way in which he's talked about women. A couple of years ago, he got into an online fight with environmental activist Greta Thunberg, you might recall, when he bragged about his 33 Lamborghinis and other big cars and their enormous emissions, as he called him. Now, he's been in Romania for several years living there. The case against him involves 7 women who say they were misled and transported to Romania, where they were then sexually exploited, and he faces those similar charges in the United Kingdom.
Do we know whether the Trump administration did play a role in getting their travel restrictions relaxed so they could come to the U.S.?
The Financial Times reported last week that members of the Trump administration pressed Romanian authorities to lift the travel restrictions. President Trump was asked about that at the White House yesterday, and he said he didn't know anything about it. Here in Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis was also asked about it yesterday, whether he had any advance notice that Andrew Tate and his brother were headed here, and he said no. He also had this to say.
Florida is not a place where you're welcome with that type of conduct in the air, and I don't know how it came to this. We were not involved. We were not notified. I found out through the media.
DeSantis says it's up to the federal government, not the state, to decide whether to allow the Tate brothers to enter the country. And he said Florida's attorney general is looking at what jurisdiction the state may have over any of the charges that are outstanding. Now, both Andrew and Tristan Tate are U.S. British citizens. Interestingly, President Trump is expected to be at Mar-a-Lago just up the highway in this weekend, and there's no indication yet of whether or not the Tates might be invited for a visit.
That is NPR's Greg Allen in Miami. Greg, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, how life can change in a second. Writer Hanif Qureshi's first film, 1985's My Beautiful Laundrette, starred Daniel Day-Lewis and won Qureshi an Oscar for Best Screenplay. In 2022, he fell, and when he regained consciousness, his limbs were paralyzed. We'll talk about life before and after the fall. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. From Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19, the CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Some recent electric car buyers are getting an unpleasant surprise this tax season. They expected a big tax credit, but their returns are getting rejected. NPR's Camila Domonoske looked into why.
Christina Meyer did everything right. The EV tax credit can be fiddly, but it's valuable, worth up to $4,000 off a used vehicle or $7,500 off a new one. Meyer was eyeing a plug-in hybrid minivan last fall, and that credit made a difference.
That definitely makes it way more affordable for us. I mean, the tax credit itself is about almost a year in, car payments.
So Meyer was extra careful. She did her research about how to claim the credit. That was extra important last year because the rules had changed in 2024. In order for buyers to actually get the tax credit, dealers had to use a new online system to report the sale to the IRS and then give a confirmation to buyers like Meyer.
I had read the IRS website and I sent all the instructions to the dealership and everything.
Before they drove off in their new van, Meyer and her husband took their old SUV, their first family car, for a goodbye spin.
I cried a little bit. I like teared up because this is the car that I brought like both of my kids home in, after giving birth. It was really bittersweet.
And Meyer also reminded her car dealer, don't forget to get us that tax paperwork. The whole point of the IRS's new system was to let car buyers get the tax credit up front as a rebate, cash on the table, instead of waiting for a credit at tax time. It was obvious dealers needed to sign up for that new system to offer customers that instant rebate. But some dealers seem not to have realized that if they didn't sign up, their customers couldn't get the credit ever, even at tax time. Meyer did everything right, but her dealership didn't. They weren't using the new portal. They followed the old process, and the tax document they sent her was outdated. Her tax return was rejected.
I feel like we've been potentially going through like the stages of grief almost.
Steve Barber is a CPA who works with hundreds of car dealerships, and he worked to prevent this sort of thing. So did the IRS and dealer trade groups, who all spent months trying to spread the word to dealers about the new system.
We wrote a lot of stuff to make sure the bulletins are out there to make sure dealers are doing it.
Most dealers have signed up for the new system. And Barber says it was very clear, black and white, that if you didn't, your buyers couldn't get the tax credit.
It's been out there.
But he says he's not surprised if some dealers missed the news. Michael Garza is the general manager of Lithia Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram of Santa Fe, the New Mexico dealership that sold Meyer her van. He says the dealership just used the form they already had.
I just found out today that it was the wrong form.
NPR has spoken to six buyers around the country who are all in a similar boat. Their various dealerships didn't report the sale in the new system, so their tax credits are getting rejected. For some of those buyers, their dealers won't return their phone calls. Others, like Meyer's dealer, are trying to help. An employee there showed her they've now signed up for the portal, but the IRS system won't let them report the sales retroactively. Meyer was planning to use the EV tax credit to help build up savings. One buyer was going to pay off a student loan. One retiree on a fixed income bought a used EV and was hoping to use the credit to help pay bills like his heating oil. Now, hundreds of thousands of people did get their tax credits up front from dealers who did follow the new process. Allison Flores is a tax expert with H&R Block. She says there are a lot of advantages to the new system, but, well, it's a new system.
The rules really change significantly for dealers and for consumers.
And that increases the risk of mistakes. Tax season still has weeks to go, and lots of people haven't submitted returns yet. But Flores says H&R Block is seeing more EV credits rejected than they expected.
So we know this is out there. We're just not sure how common it is.
This is a problem the IRS could fix, including by allowing sellers to report sales belatedly. It's done that before. The IRS did not comment in time for this story, and the agency is laying off thousands of people, including employees hired specifically to help taxpayers navigate problems. Flores says anybody planning to claim the EV credit on their taxes should file ASAP. And if you're buying an EV this year, getting the tax credit up front will avoid this kind of problem. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
The holy month of Ramadan begins tonight, and for many Muslim children, it's a time to learn about celebrating their faith, spiritual growth, and a sacred challenge.
Muslim kids typically begin fasting all day for Ramadan around the time they hit puberty. But some can't wait to get started. Take 8.5-year-old Dunya Esfahani in Michigan.
I feel like fasting is really fun to do because it makes me feel closer to God. I want to also be like my parents.
Dunya's mom is Maryam Gelvani. She says this is the first year Dunya plans to fast from dawn to sunset for the entire month.
It's a big deal. It's a big step. We've decorated around the house. We just had an inflatable Ramadan Mubarak sign delivered to the house.
The Gelvanis live in Dearborn, which is home to the biggest population of Arab Americans in the U.S. Gelvani's friend and fellow parent, Nawal Al-Sayed, grew up in Dearborn. She says kids there who don't fast during Ramadan can feel a little excluded.
You're at elementary school, like 99% of the kids are also fasting. Sometimes if you're not fasting, you're like, well, I feel a little left out. I want to be a part of this.
Al-Sayed's eldest is 13, and she says he is used to fasting for the whole day. Her younger kids, aged 11 and 9, are eager to join him, but she's trying not to rush it.
I'm like, okay, let's aim for half-day fasts. If you can push it past a half-day fast, that's fine too.
After sunset each evening, Al-Sayed's family plans to break their fast with chewy dates and jalab, a drink made with date syrup, rose water, and nuts. After that,
they are just like, bring on all the Arabic sweets, the kanafa, the asmaliyya, the shaibiyya.
8.5-year-old Dunya Esfahani says she looks forward to breaking her fast with her mom's lasagna, or maybe a guilty pleasure or two.
There's a few other foods not that healthy that I want, like mac and cheese or stuff like that.
When it comes to the safety of fasting for kids, pediatricians have mixed opinions. Some say they shouldn't, especially before puberty. Others say it's fine, as long as they don't overexert themselves and they eat healthy food and hydrate when the sun is down.
So for those of all ages who celebrate, however you do it, Ramadan Mubarak. This is NPR News.
Black architects helped shape the modern architecture movement in the United States, but their contributions have long been overlooked.
It's important to save these buildings because of the historical stories they tell, the social stories they tell.
I'm Elsa Chang, the effort to highlight the lives and works of Black architects in America on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Trump is hosting Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky at the White House this hour. He does so with an eye toward negotiating a lasting peace deal between Russia and Ukraine 3 years after Moscow's full-scale invasion. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports from Kyiv. Both leaders are expected to enter a yet-to-be-finalized agreement that grants the U.S. access to Ukraine's rare earth minerals.
The idea of swapping revenue from Ukraine's natural resources for continued U.S. support came from Zelensky himself last year as part of his proposal to end the war. Zelensky says the deal on the table today is a framework rather than a final agreement, and it says the U.S. and Ukraine will jointly develop deposits of rare earth metals and critical minerals.
NPR's Joanna Kakissis reporting. As President Trump seeks closer relations with Russia, he has accused Ukraine of starting the war. He also calls Zelensky a dictator. Well, asked about that yesterday, Trump said he could not believe he'd said that. The first phase of the Israel-Hamas ceasefire expires tomorrow. Today, mourners are burying the remains of one of the last hostages released by Hamas so far in exchange for the release of hundreds of Palestinian prisoners, including some women and children held by Israel. Israeli officials say Hamas is still holding 59 hostages, half of whom are believed to be dead. U.S. stocks are trading higher this hour. The Dow is up 133 points. This is NPR. As Pope Francis continues to recover from his battle with pneumonia in a Rome hospital, the Vatican is preparing to have a cardinal fill in for the 88-year-old pontiff over Ash Wednesday services next week. Around the world, people of Christian faith will observe a 40-day period of spiritual reflection leading to Easter. Lent begins on Ash Wednesday. College students across Kentucky are taking part in demonstrations for diversity, equity, and inclusion today. Samantha Morrill of member station WMKY reports on the response to a proposed law that would bar public post-secondary institutions in Kentucky from investing resources on DEI.
Kentucky House Bill 4 targets DEI programming and other, quote, discriminatory and differential policies. Some students are pushing back. Bree Yates is a junior at Morehead State University and president of Alliance, an LGBTQ plus student organization that helped organize the demonstration. Yates says supporters want to be seen.
There are people in Kentucky, all around Kentucky, who care very deeply about DEI and will be affected by it if there are changes and cancellations to the program.
Kentucky's Day of DEI demonstrations are taking place at all 8 public universities in the state. For NPR News, I'm Samantha Morrill in Moorhead, Kentucky.
I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is trying to find her party's path back to power. We sat with the New York lawmaker for a video interview, and I asked her to pick one word to describe the state of her party. She gave it some thought.
Resolved? If I had to pick one word, it would be resolved.
It's not shocked or dismayed or anything like that at this moment?
I mean, in this moment, I think we've moved through shock. I think we've moved through dismay. I think we've moved through the five stages of grief.
Ocasio-Cortez has had an eventful career. She was a surprise election winner in 2018, a former bartender turned social media star, insurgent, and democratic socialist. Today, she's a more established lawmaker and still just 35. This week, she joined every other Democrat in voting no on a Republican budget plan.
I do believe that the Republican Party is making certain large errors right now.
She says the Republican plan to cut Medicaid may give Democrats a lot to work with. But AOC, as she's called, knows her party is a long way from recovery. Even her own blue state of New York moved in President Trump's direction last year. Many working-class voters that she claims to represent voted for Trump. What do you think President Trump has done right that has appealed to traditional Democratic constituencies?
Some of his campaign promises, he does a good job of pairing what I would say some of the largest giveaways to the 1% and elites with very tangible policy promises.
No tax on tips.
Exactly. You take no tax on tips, no tax on Social Security. These things sound great. They also directly appeal to very specific pockets of people who tend to be working class. And that creates a permission structure, right? You toss a crumb to us and you give the farm to the big fish.
Some of those promises are things that Democrats themselves would like, capping interest rates on credit cards, to give one example. Has there been some discussion among Democrats that, I mean, you're almost a little envious? He's gotten ahead of you on some of these issues.
Well, the credit card interest rate cap is my bill from 2019 with Senator Sanders.
She's hoping for a bipartisan accomplishment, working with Senator Josh Hawley, a Republican who was on this program yesterday. Yet it's clear from our own voter interviews over time that Democrats have another concern. To what extent is immigration as an issue part of your problem with working class voters?
I mean, I guess my question would be, what does the word problem mean?
People voting for the other side and not for you.
Yeah.
Feeling that Democrats are not serious about the issue in ways that it concern them.
I think that we have a problem on immigration because of the lack of progress that we've had on this issue. And as we know, Republicans weaponize that lack of progress. They are completely uninterested in addressing undocumented people, in addressing a path to citizenship.
Well, they do want to address undocumented people by removing them. I mean, that's what the president is attempting now.
Even then, you see what Republicans did with the Lake and Riley Act. They authorized the complete gutting of due process. So now you can take a DACA recipient, a dreamer, just accuse them of a crime.
And deport them.
And deport them. However, they also understand that they don't even have the infrastructure to do that. It's not even about creating a deportation pipeline. They are creating a private prison camp pipeline.
Since the election, many Democrats have said that they need a tougher approach to immigration. Ocasio-Cortez still argues that many people who are here without legal status should stay, and that led to a recent dispute with Tom Homan, the president's border czar. You held an online forum, a Know Your Rights forum, that he didn't like. What were you doing? What was your goal as you saw it?
I was informing all of my constituents of their constitutional protections, and in particular, their constitutional protections against illegal search and seizure in the United States.
Homan was upset, I suppose, because he felt that you were giving advice to people who are here illegally. Were you?
I was giving advice to all of my constituents. Yeah.
He said he was going to report you, or even that he did reach out to the Department of Justice. Have you heard from the Department of Justice?
I have not, and I intend on reaching out to the Department of Justice to inquire.
Really? What would your question be for the Department of Justice?
Well, there is a member of the Trump administration who is threatening and seeks to open an inquiry. And are you going to do it?
After our interview, Ocasio-Cortez sent a letter to the Justice Department, which she shared with NPR. The letter asks Attorney General Pam Bondi if she has, quote, yielded to political pressure trying to weaponize the agency against elected officials whose speech they disagree with. I'm interested if you or your fellow Democrats are at all feeling intimidated or silenced.
I'm not. I think it's important to call this administration's bluff. I think that this is what authoritarians do. I think this is what kleptocracies do. They rely on the illusion of power.
Ocasio-Cortez is preparing for the next round of competition with the president. She thinks Trump's bid to fire federal workers will hurt him in the end, even though she agrees that many voters feel the government is not working for them.
Everything feels increasingly like a scam, that not only are grocery prices going up, but it's like everything has a fee and a surcharge. And I think that anger is put out at government.
Would you like a president to go in and break some china and mess things up, even if you don't like the way this president is trying to do that?
I think when we talk about breaking things, messing things up, I mean, to the FAA, no. To the NIH, no. To our ability to contain Ebola before it gets on a plane and comes into the United States, no. I don't want someone being reckless. I actually don't want someone taking a wrecking ball to someone's chemotherapy to just see what happens. Now, I do think that we can examine certain things like Medicare Advantage that I think is a scam, that in the name of so-called efficiency, ironically enough, we have handed over huge amounts of healthcare disbursements to private insurers who are pocketing it. Sure, yeah, let's go after that. But I don't think we just destroy everything that we have worked so hard for as a country to become innovative, to become just, to have some of the only lifelines that people have in this country to a roof over their head or food in their children's stomach. No, I don't think that we gamble with that.
Representative Ocasio-Cortez, thanks so much for coming by.
Of course. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
She's one of the Democrats trying to find their way back into power. This was a video interview, which you can see on YouTube or on the NPR app. This is NPR News.
Obama administration top technology officer Jennifer Paulka says government services can and should improve, but she worries about Elon Musk's approach. Next time, here and now.
The latest in national politics, inspiring podcasts, and a report from your local school board meeting last week. You can hear it all in one place with the NPR app. Download it today.
Good morning, I'm Martinez. A scrunchie, two hair ties, a shoe insole, a doll's dress, and 24 socks. No, not what I found in my MERS. It's what a Los Angeles area vet found inside the stomach of a seven-month-old Bernese Mountain puppy named Luna. They're a large breed. They can get over 100 pounds when fully grown. Luna's tummy, though, is cleared out now, and she is recovering. At least now, if someone's missing, say, like a pair of jeans, they'll know where to start looking. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. A federal judge says the Trump administration illegally fired thousands of federal workers on probationary status. He ruled yesterday. Probationary status includes new hires, but also workers who just got promoted. NPR's Chris Arnold introduces us to two of them.
Eileen and James Kramer, until 2 weeks ago, worked at the sprawling 4-million-acre Lake Clark National Park in Alaska.
There's one volcano that way, beyond those mountains that way. Lake Clark is behind us.
The couple is showing me the scenery off the back porch of the house that they may soon have to vacate because it's owned by the Park Service.
It's more than just losing our job. We're losing our life. We're losing our house.
We've given so much to this place and we've created a life here, and that's being taken away dishonestly.
Here's why they say dishonestly and why what's happening to this couple and thousands of other workers may not be legal. Eileen and James have worked in the park for about 10 years and both recently got promoted. She's in logistics, he's a biological science technician. Their promotions put them into probationary status. Still, legal experts say that doesn't mean that the Trump administration can just summarily fire them. Even probationary workers have protections. But an agency is allowed to fire a probationary worker for bad performance or conduct. So it appears that the administration is citing bad performance when it sends workers termination letters, even though workers like James and Eileen Kramer say that's a lie.
Yeah, that was really, I think, the hardest part about it. Was that they were saying we were underperforming, which isn't true.
They obviously didn't look at our personnel file because we have evidence showing that we've exceeded expectations and we've received performance awards.
I got a regional award specifically in efficiency last year.
She got an award for efficiency. This whole mass firing, of course, is part of the Trump administration's supposed effort to increase efficiency in government. A lawsuit on behalf of federal workers takes issue with these firing notices, alleging that the Trump administration, quote, has perpetuated one of the most massive employment frauds in the history of this country. Yesterday, a federal judge sided with the workers, ruling that an office in the administration exceeded its authority with these mass firings. The government had argued that it didn't because each agency made their own decisions. It's not yet clear exactly how this is going to affect workers who were already let go. Michelle Berkovich is a lawyer working on a separate legal effort to help probationary workers.
They had good performance, good relationship with their supervisor, and were terminated using the same letter. This is an attempt to circumvent various procedures, policies, or requirements designed to protect employees.
Basically, Berkovich says if a government agency wants to do a mass layoff, that's called a reduction in force, and there are rules that need to be followed. A lot of planning is required. At the National Park in Alaska, Eileen and James Kramer say there was no apparent planning to the layoffs there. They say half the staff who live on site at the park were fired, including a 20-year veteran who had just become a supervisor. They say he's the only one who knew how to fix the boats and the trucks and the heaters.
He's also emergency response. He's a boat captain. He's an EMT. He's the one that's going to come rescue you if you get in trouble in the backcountry. He can fix pretty much anything.
Exactly. The superintendent even said, you can fire me. The park will still run without me, but without Warren, we can't do anything.
The couple says none of these firings seem to have anything to do with waste or inefficiency. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Conspiracies have been a force in American politics for a long time now. NPR's Embedded has a new series out looking at the way they've divided one family. Last year, reporter Zach Mack's father revealed a list of 10 predictions that he thought would happen in 2024, ranging from politicians such as former President Barack Obama going to prison for treason to the entire country going under martial law. And then he challenged his son to a bet. He wagered a lot of money that his predictions would all happen within the year. Here's Zach.
And if you are wrong,
then you're $10,000 richer. I think that once you see that I haven't been duped by AI and social media, I think you will gain a lot more respect for who I am and how I come to believe.
The series is called Alternate Realities, and it follows Zach's year-long journey as he tried to bring his father back from the conspiracy rabbit hole. Now, because their story is so personal, Zach's parents have asked us not to use their names, and Zach refers to them simply as Mom and Dad in the podcast. Zach, so this bet, $10,000 that these predictions would happen all within a year, strikes, I think, a lot of people as pretty unusual. What was that like for you?
Yeah, it was very surprising. First thing you should know is my dad and I are not big gamblers, nor are we rich. But I sort of immediately saw the bet as an opportunity because, like, instead of just having these circular arguments like we had been doing for years, now we sort of were able to put his beliefs to the test. And we knew that in a year, we would be able to tell who was right and who was wrong. And that was very appealing to me. I was pretty sure that he was gonna lose. So I felt pretty good going into the bet and was hopeful that when this all shook out and he had lost, that maybe he would be a little more open to reality and we could pull him out of the rabbit hole a little bit.
These predictions painted a really dark portrait of the direction this country was going in. I mean, where was he getting all this stuff from?
Yeah, I think a lot of these ideas have just been floating around the right-wing conspiracy sphere for a long time. But my father specifically, he's deeply religious, very Christian, and he has come to believe in something called the prophetic word, which is that God still speaks through intermediaries, that God still speaks through prophets. And he has been watching all these people online who claim to be prophets, who claim that God is speaking through them, and they're making these bold proclamations and predictions about the future. And he's watching them for several hours a week. And that's where he's getting a lot of this stuff.
Okay. Now, your mom and sister are also very present in this series. And a lot of what they and your father share is incredibly vulnerable. The series really provides a very intimate portrait of the impact that misinformation can have on a family. So what was the making of this documentary like for you and actually for them?
It was like incredibly difficult. I'm not used to reporting on myself or my own family. I think the thing that helped get me through it is that I had the full support of the family, that my mom, my sister, my father, they were all participating and supportive of the project and open to the idea of being involved. So that helped a lot. But generally, this has been quite difficult. My mom still lives with my father. And it's been really hard as she's seen him start to, you know, hoard survivalist supplies in preparation for like the grid going down and trying to put some of their money into things like precious metals without telling her. It's been quite hard for her.
I want a date. And then when that date happens, the precious metals gets returned to cash. The flask of water go back to Costco. You do something else with the food generators we now have and you move on.
We were all hopeful that at the end of this bet, when he saw that he was wrong, that he would come back to reality a little bit and we'd sort of get to be a family again.
Yeah. Now, all year long, you interviewed your dad. What's the most important thing that you learned about talking to people who have gotten swept up in these kind of conspiracy theories?
Yeah. I talked to a lot of clinicians and conspiracy experts about this. A lot of the research is still out and very much varies person to person. I know for my father and I, what was really helpful was just being more empathetic and more curious about why these beliefs were enticing to him. I don't think just berating him with facts, that wasn't working. We were having these circular arguments. So once I really tried to understand him, I thought we were able to have much better conversations. And ultimately, I wasn't really able to change his mind, but we were able to get a lot closer through the course of making this show. And the unfortunate reality is just that it is extremely difficult to pull people away from these ideas once they've taken hold.
All right, that's reporter Zach Mack. You can hear the entire story about what happened to Zach and his family in his new series called Alternate Realities on NPR's Embedded Podcast. All the episodes are out now. Zach, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
If you love to sew or do other projects with fabric, you might have already headed to your local Joann's store to pick through what's left. Joann's, for the non-crafty, used to be the country's biggest fabric retailer, but it went bankrupt. And this week it started closing some 800 stores.
I've been to a couple of the stores, and I walk out and I cry.
Ingrid Crapo is a professional maker of things with fabric.
I have 10 sewing machines. I've done everything from uniforms for the University of Maryland to mascots for all of the sports teams in D.C.
Crapo says she will miss a well-stocked fabric store. She says the craft stores closest to her don't have much of a selection, and she calls online shopping for fabric a nightmare.
Bet you didn't know, Michelle, that Joann Fabrics started out as, of all things, a cheese shop in Cleveland during World War II. German immigrants Hilda and Berthold Reich sold cheese and fabric in a little store they ran along with their friends, Sigmund and Matilda Rohrbach.
I did not know that. And you know what? Hey, none of them was named Joann.
No, but the store was named after their daughters, Joan and Jacqueline Ann, and it sold more fabric than cheese.
And back then, making your own clothes was often cheaper than buying off the rack.
Sewing is the lost art in America.
Mike Edwards, vice president at Joann's in the early 2000s.
At the time, we were testing and rolling out sort of superstores, meaning 30 to 40,000 square foot fabric stores.
But the fabric market was shrinking.
A lot of people don't own sewing machines anymore.
A sales boost, though, during the pandemic only delayed the inevitable. And now Allison Linz Bentley says she'll shop online to teach sewing in Brentwood, Maryland.
A lot of online retailers have gotten a lot savvier about how to communicate fabrics, showing videos of things, showing people stretching the fabric or moving the fabric.
Bentley says crafty people will eventually find a workaround to get the fabric they need.
People can go to thrift stores. They can also channel Sound of Music and turn their curtains into play clothes. There's a lot of things that people can do.
I guess that's why they call them creatives. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by BJ Lederman. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Amy Martinez.
Where?